You were afraid of my city and keenly suspicious of towering Carthage's hospitality. But how will it all end? Where is our rivalry taking us? Would it not be far better by arranging a marriage to seal a lasting peace? You have got the thing you had set your heart on. Dido's afire with love, wholly infatuated. Well then, let us unite these nations and rule them with equal authority. Let Dido slave for a Trojan husband, and let the Tyrians pass into your hand as her dowry. Venus, aware that this was double talk by which Juno aimed at basing the future Italian empire on Africa, countered with these words. Senseless indeed to reject such terms and prefer to settle the matter with you by hostilities, provided fortune favour the plan which you propose. But I'm in two minds about destiny. I'm not sure if Jupiter wishes one city formed of Tyrians and Trojan exiles, or would approve a pact of miscegenation between them. You are his wife. You may ask him to make his policy clearer. Proceed. I will support you. Queen Juno replied thus, "That shall be my task. Now, to solve our immediate problem, I will briefly put forward a scheme. Pray give me your attention. Aeneas and his unfortunate Dido plan to go a-hunting in the woods tomorrow, as soon as the sun has risen and unshrouded the world below with his rays. On these two, while the beaters are scurrying about and stopping the coverts with cordon of nets, I shall pour down a darkling rainstorm and hail as well, and send thunder hallooing all over the sky. Dispersing for shelter, the rest of the hunt will be cloaked in the murk. But Dido and Lord Aeneas, finding their way to the same cave, shall meet. I'll be there. And if I may rely on your goodwill, there I shall join them in lasting marriage and seal her his, with Hymen present, in person." Venus made no opposition to Juno's request, though she smiled at the ingenuity of it. So now, as Aurora was rising out of her ocean bed and the daybeam lofted, there sallied forth the elite of Carthage, with fine-meshed nets and snares and the broad hunting lances, Massilian riders galloped behind a keen-nosed pack. The queen dallies. The foremost Carthaginians await her by the palace door. Where stands her horse, caparisoned in purple and gold, high-spirited, champing the foam-flecked bit? At last she comes, with many courtiers in attendance. She wears a Phoenician habit, piped with bright-coloured braid. Her quiver is gold, her hair bound up with a golden clasp. A brooch of gold fastens the waist of her brilliant dress. Her Trojan friends were there too, and young Ascanius in high glee. But by far the handsomest of them all was Aeneas, who came to her side now and joined forces with hers. It was like when Apollo leaves Lycia his winter palace and Xanthus River to visit Delos, his mother's home, and renew the dances, while round his altar Cretans and Dryopes and the tattooed Agatherse are raising a polyglot din. The god himself steps out on the Cynthian range, a circlet of gold and a wreath of pliant bay on his flowing hair, the jangling weapons slung from his shoulder. Nimble as he, Aeneas moved with the same fine glow on his handsome face. When they had reached the mountains, the trackless haunt of game, wild goats, picture the scene, started from crags up above there, ran down the slopes. From another direction, stags were galloping over the open ground of a glen, deserting the heights, a whole herd jostling together in flight with a dust cloud above it. But young Ascanius, proud of his mettlesome horse, was riding along the vale, outstripping group after group of hunters, and praying hard that instead of such tame quarry, a frothing boar might come his way, or a sand-coloured mountain lion. At this stage, a murmur, a growling began to be heard in the sky. Soon followed a deluge of rain and hail together. The Trojan sportsmen, Their Carthaginian friends and the grandson of Venus, in some alarm, scattered over the terrain looking for shelter. Torrents roared down from the mountaintops. Now Dido and the Prince Aeneas found themselves in the same cave. Primordial Earth and presiding Juno gave the signal. The firmament flickered with fire, a witness of wedding. Somewhere above, the nymphs cried out in pleasure. That day was doom's first birthday, and that first day was the cause of evils. Dido recked nothing for appearance or reputation. The love she brooded on now was a secret love no longer. Marriage, she called it, drawing the word to veil her sin. Straightway went rumour through the great cities of Libya, rumour, the swiftest traveller of all the ills on earth, thriving on movement, gathering strength as it goes. At the start a small and cowardly thing, it soon puffs itself up, and walking upon the ground, buries its head in the cloud base. The legend is that, enraged with the gods, Mother Earth produced this creature, her last child, as a sister to Enceladus and Coeus, a swift-footed creature, a winged angel of ruin, a terrible, grotesque monster, each feather upon whose body, incredible though it sounds, has a sleepless eye beneath it, and for every eye she also has a tongue, a voice, and a pricked ear. At night she flits midway between earth and sky, through the gloom screeching, and never closes her eyelids in sweet slumber. By day she is perched like a lookout, either upon a rooftop or some high turret. So she terrorizes whole cities, loud speaker of truth, hoarder of mischievous falsehood, equally. This creature was now regaling the people with various scandal in great glee, announcing fact and fiction indiscriminately. Item? Aeneas has come here, a prince of Trojan blood, and the beauteous Dido deigns to have her name linked with his. The couple are spending the winter in debauchery, the whole long winter, forgetting their kingdoms, wrapped in a trance of lust. Such gossip did vile rumour pepper on every mouth. Not long before she came to the ears of King Iarbas, whispering inflammatory words and heaping up his resentment. He, the son of Ammon by a ravished African nymph, had established 100 shrines to Jove in his ample realm, 100 altars, and consecrated their quenchless flames and vigils unceasing there. The ground was richly steeped in victims' blood, and bouquets of flowers adorned the portals. He now, driven out of his mind by that bitter blast of rumour, there, at the altar, among the presences of the gods, prayed, it is said, to Jove with importunate, humble entreaty. Almighty Jove, whom now for the first time the Moorish people pledge with wine as they banquet on ornamental couches, do you observe these things? Or are we foolish to shudder when you shoot fire, O Father? Foolish to be dismayed by lightning, which is quite aimless, and thunder, which growls without meaning? That woman, who, wandering within our frontiers, paid to establish her insignificant township, permitted by us to plough up a piece of the coast and be queen of it, that woman, rejecting my offer of marriage, has taken Aeneas as lord and master there. And now that philanderer, with his effeminate following, his chin and oil-sleeked hair set off by a Phrygian bonnet, that fellow is in possession, while we bring gifts to your shrine. If indeed you are there, and we do not worship a vain myth. Thus did Iarbas pray, with his hands on the altar. And Jove omnipotent, hearing him, bent down his gaze upon Dido's city, and on those lovers lost to their higher fame. Then he addressed Mercury, entrusting to him this errand. Go quick, my son. whistle up the zephyrs and wing your way down to the Trojan leader, who is dallying now in Carthage without one thought for the city which fate has assigned to be his. Carry my dictate along the hastening winds, and tell him, not for such ways did his matchless mother guarantee him to us, not for such ends rescue him twice from the Greeks, rather that he should rule an Italy, fertile in leadership and loud with war, should hand on a line which sprang from the noble Teucer, and bring the whole world under a system of law. If the glory of such great exploits no longer fires his heart, and for his own renown he will make no effort at all, does he grudge his son Ascanius the glory of Rome to be? What aim, what hope does he cherish, delaying there in a hostile land, with no thought for posterity or his Italian kingdom? Let him sail, that is the gist. Give him that message from me. Jove spake. Mercury now got ready to obey his father's command. So first he bound on his feet the sandals, the golden sandals, whose wings waft him aloft over sea and land alike with the hurrying breath of the breezes. Then he took up his magic wand. With this he summons wan ghosts from Orcus, and consigns others to dreary Tartarus, gives sleep or takes it away, seals up the eyes of dead men. Now, with that trusty wand, he drove the winds and threshed through the cloud-rack, descried as he flew the peak and precipitous flanks of Atlas, that dour mountain which props the sky with his summit. Atlas, his pine-bristled head forever enwrapped in a bandeau of glooming cloud, forever beaten by wind and rain. Snow lies deep on his shoulders, and watercourses plunge down that ancient's chin, while his shaggy beard is stiff with ice. Here first did Mercury pause, hovering on beautifully balanced wings, then stooped, dived bodily down to the sea below, like a bird which along the shore and around the promontories goes fishing, flying low, wave-hopping over the water. Even so did Mercury skim between earth and sky towards the Libyan coast, cutting his path through the winds on his way from that mountain giant Atlas, his mother's sire. As soon as his winged feet had carried him to the shacks there, he noticed Aeneas superintending the work on towers and new buildings. He wore a sword studded with yellow jaspers, and a fine cloak of glowing Tyrian purple hung from his shoulders. The wealthy Dido had fashioned it, interweaving the fabric with threads of gold as a present to him. Mercury went for him at once. "So now you are laying foundations for lofty Carthage, building a beautiful city to please a woman, lost to the interests of your own realm? The king of the gods, who directs heaven and earth with his deity, sends me to you from bright Olympus. The king of the gods gave me this message to carry express through the air. What do you aim at or hope for, idling and fiddling here in Libya? If you're indifferent to your own high destiny, and for your own renown you will make no effort at all, think of your young hopeful, Ascanius, growing to manhood, the inheritance which you owe him, an Italian kingdom, the soil of Rome." Such were the words which Mercury delivered, and breaking off abruptly, was manifest no more, but vanished into thin air, far beyond human ken. Dazed indeed by that vision was Aeneas, and dumbfounded. His hair stood on end with terror, the voice stuck in his throat. Awed by this admonition from the great throne above, he desired to fly the country, dear though it was to him. But oh, what was he to do? What words could he find to get round the temperamental queen? How broach the matter to her? His mind was in feverish conflict, tossed from one side to the other, twisting and turning all ways to find a way past his dilemma. So, vacillating, at last he felt this the better decision. Sending for Nicias, Sergestus, and brave Serestus, he bade them secretly get the ships ready, muster their friends on the beach, be prepared to fight. The cause of so drastic a change of plan they must keep dark. In the meanwhile, assuming that generous Dido knew nothing and could not imagine the end of so great a love, Aeneas would try for a way to approach her, the kindest moment for speaking, the best way to deal with this delicate matter. His comrades obeyed the command and did as he told them with cheerful alacrity. But who can ever hoodwink a woman in love? The queen, apprehensive even when things went well, now sensed his deception, got wind of what was going to happen. That mischievous rumour, whispering the fleet was preparing to sail, put her in a frenzy. Distraught, she witlessly wandered about the city, raving like some Bacchante driven wild when the emblems of sanctity stir by the shouts of Hail Bacchus, and drawn to Cithaeron at night by the din of revellers at the triennial orgies. Finding Aeneas at last, she cried, before he could speak,
"Unfaithful man! Did you think you could do such a dreadful thing and keep it dark? Yes, skulk from my land without one word? Our love, the vows you made me, do these not give you pause, not even the thought of Dido meeting a painful death? Now, in the dead of winter, to be getting your ships ready and hurrying to set sail when northerly gales are blowing? You heartless one! Suppose the fields were not foreign, the home was not strange that you are bound for. Suppose Troy stood as of old. Would you be sailing for Troy now, in this stormy weather? Am I your reason for going? By these tears, by the hand you gave me, they are all I have left today in my misery. I implore you, and by our union of hearts, by our marriage hardly begun, if I have ever helped you at all, if anything about me pleased you, be sad for our broken home. Forgo your purpose, I beg you, unless it's too late for prayers of mine. Because of you, the Libyan tribes and the nomad chieftains hate me. The Tyrians are hostile. Because of you, I have lost my old reputation for faithfulness, the one thing that could have made me immortal. Oh, I am dying. To what, my guest, are you leaving me? Guest! That is all I may call you now, who have called you husband. Why do I linger here? Shall I wait till my brother Pygmalion destroys this place, or Iarbas leads me away captive? If even I might have conceived a child by you before you went away, a little Aeneas to play in the palace, and in spite of all this, to remind me of you by his looks. Oh, then I should not feel so utterly finished and desolate.
She had spoken. Aeneas, mindful of Jove's words, kept his eyes unyielding, and with a great effort repressed his feeling for her. In the end, he managed to answer. Dido, I'll never pretend you have not been good to me, deserving of everything you can claim. I shall not regret my memories of Elissa as long as I breathe, as long as I remember my own self. For my conduct, this, briefly. I did not look to make off from here in secret. Do not suppose it. Nor did I offer you marriage at any time, or consent to be bound by a marriage contract. If fate allowed me to be my own master, and gave me free will to choose my way of life, to solve my problems, old Troy would be my first choice. I would restore it, and honour my people's relics, the high halls of Priam perpetuated, Troy given back to its conquered sons, a renaissant city, had been my task. But now, Apollo and the Lycian oracle have told me that Italy is our bourne. There lies my heart, my homeland. You, a Phoenician, are held by these Carthaginian towers, by the charm of your Libyan city. So can you grudge us Trojans our vision of settling down in Italy? We too may seek a kingdom abroad. Often as night envelops the earth in dewy darkness, often as star rise, the troubled ghost of my father, Anchises, comes to me in my dreams, warns me, and frightens me. I am disturbed no less by the wrong I am doing Ascanius, defrauding him of his destined realm in Hesperia. What's more, just now the courier of heaven, sent by Jupiter, I swear it on your life and mine, conveyed to me, swiftly flying, his orders. I saw the god, as clear as day, with my own eyes, entering the city, and these ears drank in the words he uttered. No more reproaches, then. They only torture us both. God's will, not mine, says Italy. All the while he was speaking, she gazed at him askance, her glances flickering over him, eyes exploring the whole man in deadly silence. Now, furiously, she burst out,
"Faithless and false! No goddess mothered you, no Dardanus, your ancestor! I believe harsh Caucasus begat you on a flint-hearted rock, and Hyrcanian tigers suckled you. Why should I hide my feelings? What worse can there be to keep them for? Not one sigh from him when I wept, not a softer glance. Did he yield an inch or a tear in pity for her who loves him? I don't know what to say first. It has come to this. Not Juno, not Jove himself can view my plight with the eye of justice. Nowhere is it safe to be trustful. I took him, a castaway, a pauper, and shared my kingdom with him. I must have been mad, rescued his lost fleet, rescued his friends from death. Oh, I'm on fire and drifting. And now, Apollo's prophecies, Lycian oracles, couriers of heaven sent by Jupiter with stern commands, all these order you to betray me. Oh, of course this is just the sort of transaction that troubles the calm of the gods. I'll not keep you, nor probe the dishonesty of your words. Chase your Italy, then. Go! Sail to your realm overseas. I only hope that if the just spirits have any power, marooned on some mid-sea rock, you may drink the full cup of agony and often cry out for Dido. I'll dog you from far with the death fires, and when cold death has parted my soul from my body, my spectre will be wherever you are. You shall pay for the evil you've done me. The tale of your punishment will come to me down in the shades.
With these words, Dido suddenly ended, and sick at heart, turned from him, tore herself away from his eyes, ran indoors, while he hung back in dread of a still worse scene, although he had much to say. Her maids bore up the fainting queen into her marble chamber and laid her down on the bed. But the god-fearing Aeneas, much as he longed to soothe her anguish with consolation, with words that would end her troubles, heavily sighing, his heart melting from love of her, nevertheless obeyed the gods and went off to his fleet. Whereupon the Trojans redoubled their efforts, all along the beach dragging down the tall ships, launching the well-tarred bottoms, fetching green wood to make oars and bulks of unfashioned timber from the forest, so eager they were to be gone. You could see them on the move, hurrying out of the city. It looked like an army of ants when, provident for winter, they're looting a great big corn heap and storing it up in their own house. Over a field the black file goes as they carry the loot on a narrow track through the grass. Some are strenuously pushing the enormous grains of corn with their shoulders, while others marshal the traffic and keep it moving. Their whole road seethes with activity. Ah, Dido, what did you feel when you saw these things going forward? What moans you gave when, looking forth from your high rooftop, you beheld the whole length of the beach aswarm with men, and the sea's face alive with the sound and fury of preparations for sailing. Excess of love, to what lengths you drive our human hearts! Once again, she was driven to try what tears and entreaties could do, and let love beggar her pride. She would leave no appeal untried, lest, for want of it, she should all needlessly die. Anna, you see the bustle down there on the beach? From all sides they have assembled. Their canvas is stretched to the winds already, and the elated mariners have garlanded their ships. If I was able to anticipate this deep anguish, I shall be able to bear it. But do this one thing, Anna, for your poor sister. You were the only confidant of that faithless man. He told you even his secret thoughts. You alone know the most tactful way, the best time to approach him. Go, sister, and make this appeal to my disdainful enemy. Say that I never conspired with the Greeks at Aulis to ruin the Trojan people, nor sent squadrons of ships against Troy. I never desecrated the ashes of dead Anchises. So why must Aeneas be deaf and obdurate to my pleading? Why off so fast? Will he grant a last wish to her who unhappily loves him, and wait for a favouring wind, an easier voyage? Not for our marriage that was do I plead now. He has forsworn it. Nor that he go without his dear Latium and give up his kingdom. I ask a mere nothing, just time to give rein to despair and thus calm it, to learn from ill luck how to grieve for what I have lost, and to bear it. This last favour I beg. Oh, pity your sister, and if he grants it, I will repay him. My death shall be his interest. Such were her prayers, and such the tearful entreaties her agonized sister conveyed to Aeneas again and again. But unmoved by tearful entreaties he was, adamant against all pleadings. Fate blocked them. Heaven stopped his ears, lest he turn complacent. As when some stalwart oak tree, some veteran of the Alps, is assailed by a wintry wind whose veering gusts tear at it, trying to root it up, wildly whistle the branches, the leaves come flocking down from aloft as the bole is battered, but the tree stands firm on its crag, for high as its head is carried into the sky, so deep do its roots go down towards Hades. Even thus was the hero belaboured for long with every kind of pleading, and his great heart thrilled through and through with the pain of it. Resolute, though, was his mind. Unavailingly rolled her tears. But hapless Dido, frightened out of her wits by her destiny, prayed for death. She would gaze no more on the dome of daylight. And now, strengthening her resolve to act and to leave this world, she saw, as she laid gifts on the incense-burning altars, horrible to relate, the holy water turn black, and the wine she poured changing uncannily to blood. She told no one, not even her sister, of this phenomenon. Again, she had dedicated a chantry of marble within the palace to her first husband, held it in highest reverence, hung it with snow-white fleeces and with festoons of greenery. Well, from this shrine, when night covered the earth, she seemed to be hearing words, the voice of that husband calling upon her. There was something dirge-like, too, in the tones of the owl on the rooftop, whose lonely repeated cries were drawn out to a long keening. Besides, she recalled with horror presages, dread forewarnings of the prophets of old. Aeneas himself pursued her remorselessly in dreams, driving her mad, or else she dreamed of unending solitude and desertion, of walking alone and eternally down a long road through an empty land in search of her Tyrians. Just so does the raving Pentheus see covens of furies and has the delusion of seeing two suns in the sky and a double Thebes. Just so, on the stage, does Orestes, the son of Agamemnon, move wildly about while his mother pursues him with torches and black snakes, and at the door the avenging furies cut off his retreat. So, when overmastered by grief she conceived a criminal madness and doomed herself to death, she worked out the time and method in secret. Then, putting on an expression of calm hopefulness to hide her resolve, she approached her sorrowing sister with these words. "I have found out a way, Anna. Oh, wish me joy of it, to get him back or else get free of my love for him. Near ocean's furthest bound, and the sunset, is Ethiopia, the very last place on earth where giant Atlas pivots the wheeling sky, embossed with fiery stars on his shoulders. I have been in touch with a priestess from there, a Massilian, who once, as warden of the Hesperides' sacred close, was used to feed the dragon which guarded their orchard of golden apples, sprinkling its food with moist honey and sedative poppy seeds. Now this enchantress claims that her spells can liberate one's heart, or can inject love pangs just as she wishes, can stop the flow of rivers, send the stars flying backwards, conjure ghosts in the night. She can make the earth cry out under one's feet, and elm trees come trooping down from the mountains. Dear sister, I solemnly call to witness the gods and you whom I love, that I do not willingly resort to her magic arts. You must build up a funeral pyre high in the inner courtyard, and keep it dark. Lay on it the arms which that godless man has left on the pegs in our bedroom, all relics of him, and the marriage bed that was the ruin of me. To blot out all that reminds me of that vile man is my pleasure, and what the enchantress directs." So Dido spoke, and fell silent, her face going deadly white. Yet Anna never suspected that Dido was planning her own death through these queer rites, nor imagined how frantic a madness possessed her, nor feared any worse would happen than when Sychaeus had died. So she made the arrangements required of her. When in the innermost court of the palace the pyre had been built up to a great height with pine wood and logs of ilex, the queen festooned the place with garlands and wreathed it with funereal foliage. Then she laid on it the clothes, the sword which Aeneas had left, and an effigy of him. She well knew what was to happen. Altars were set up all round. Her hair unloosed, the enchantress loudly invoked 300 deities, Erebus, Chaos, Hecate, Three-in-One, and Three-Faced Diana the Virgin. She had sprinkled water which came, she pretended, from Lake Avernus, herbs she had gathered, cut by moonlight with a bronze knife, poisonous herbs all rank with juices of black venom. She had found a love charm, a gland torn from the forehead of a new-born foal before its mother could get it. Dido, the sacramental grain in her purified hands, one foot unsandaled, her dress uncinctured, stood by the altars, calling upon the gods and the stars that know fate's secrets, death at her heart, and prayed to whatever power it is holds unrequited lovers in its fair, faithful keeping. Was night. All over the earth, creatures were plucking the flower of soothing sleep, the woods and the wild seas fallen quiet, a time when constellations have reached their mid-career, when the countryside is all still, the beasts and the brilliant birds that haunt the lake's wide waters or the tangled undergrowth of the champaign, stilled in sleep under the quiet night. Cares are lulled, and hearts can forget for a while their travails. Not so, the Phoenician queen. Death at her heart, she could not ever relax in sleep, let the night into her eyes or mind. Her agonies mounted, her love reared up again and savaged her, till she writhed in a boiling sea of passion. So thus she began, her thoughts whirled round in a vicious circle. What shall I do? Shall I, who've been jilted, return to my former suitors? Go down on my knees for marriage to one of the nomads, although time and again I once rejected their offers? Well then, am I to follow the Trojans' fleet and bow to their lightest word? I helped them once. Will that help me now? Dare I think they remember with gratitude my old kindness? But even if I wished it, who would suffer me, welcome me aboard those arrogant ships? They hate me. Ah, duped and ruined. Surely by now I should know the ill faith of Laomedon's people. So then, shall I sail by myself with those exulting mariners, or sail against them with all my Tyrian folk about me, my people, whom once I could hardly persuade to depart from Sidon, bidding them man their ships and driving them out to sea again? Better die. I deserve it. End my pain with the sword. Sister, you started it all. Overborne by my tears, you laid up these evils to drive me mad, put me at the mercy of a foe. Oh, that I could have been some child of nature and lived an innocent life, untouched by marriage and all its troubles. I have broken the faith I vowed to the memory of Sychaeus. Such were the reproaches she could not refrain from uttering. High on the poop of his ship, resolute now for departure, Aeneas slept. Preparations for sailing were fully completed. To him, in a dream, there appeared the shape of the god, returning just as he'd looked before, as if giving the same admonitions. Mercury's very image, the voice, the complexion, the yellow hair, and the handsome youthful body identical. "Goddess born, can you go on sleeping at such a crisis? Are you out of your mind, not to see what dangers are brewing up around you, and not to hear the favouring breath of the west wind? Being set upon death, her heart is aswirl with conflicting passions. Aye, she is brooding now some trick, some desperate deed. Why are you not going all speed, while the going is good? If dawn finds you still here, delaying by these shores, you'll have the whole sea swarming with hostile ships. There will be firebrands coming against you. You'll see this beach ablaze. Up and away, then. No more lingering. Woman was ever a veering weathercock creature. He spoke and vanished in the darkness. Then, startled by the shock of the apparition, Aeneas snatched himself out of sleep and urgently stirred up his comrades. "Jump to it, men! To your watch! Get to the rowing benches! Smartly! Hoist the sails! A god from heaven above spurs me to cut the cables! Make off, and lose not a moment! This was his second warning! Oh, blessed God, we follow you! God indeed! And once more we obey the command joyfully! Be with us! Look kindly upon us! Grant us good sailing weather!" Thus did Aeneas cry, and flashing his sword from its scabbard, with the drawn blade he severed the moorings. The same sense of urgency fired his comrades all. They cut and ran for it. The shore lay empty. The ships covered the open sea. The oarsmen swept the blue and sent the foam flying with hard strokes. And now was Aurora, leaving the saffron bed of Tithonus, beginning to shower upon earth the light of another day. The queen, looking forth from her rooftop, as soon as she saw the sky grow pale, and the Trojan fleet running before the wind, aware that the beach and the roadstead were empty, the sailors gone, struck herself 3 times, 4 times, upon her lovely breast, tore at her yellow hair, and exclaimed, "In
God's name, shall that foreigner scuttle away and make a laughing-stock of my country? Will not my people stand to arms for a mass pursuit? Will some not rush the warships out of the docks? Move, then! Bring firebrands apace, issue the weapons, pull on the oars. What am I saying? Where am I? What madness veers my mind? Poor Dido, the wrong you have done. Is it only now coming home to you? You should have thought of that when you gave him your scepter. So this is the word of honour of one who, men say, totes round his home gods everywhere, and bore on his back a doddering father. Why could I not have seized him, torn up his body and littered the sea with it, finished his friends with the sword, finished his own Ascanius, and served him up for his father to banquet on? The outcome of battle had been uncertain. Let it have been so. Since I was to die, whom had I to fear? I should have stormed their bulwarks with fire, set alight their gangways, gutted the whole lot, folk, father, and child, then flung myself on the conflagration. Oh, sun, with your beams surveying all that is done on earth, Juno, the mediator and witness of my tragedy, Hecate, whose name is howled by night at the city crossroads, avenging furies, and you, the patrons of dying Elissa, hear me. Incline your godheads to note this wickedness so worthy of your wrath, and hear my prayer. If he, that damned soul, must make port and get to land, if thus Jove destines it, if that bourne is fixed for him irrevocably, may he be harried in war by adventurous tribes, and exiled from his own land. May Ascanius be torn from his arms, may he have to sue for aid, and see his own friends squalidly dying. Yes, and when he's accepted the terms of a harsh peace, let him never enjoy his realm or the allotted span, but fall before his time and lie on the sands unburied. That is my last prayer. I pour it out with my lifeblood. Let you, my Tyrians, sharpen your hatred upon his children and all their seed forever. Send this as a present to my ghost. Between my people and his, no love, no alliance. Rise up from my dead bones, Avenger. Rise up, one to hound the Trojan settlers with fire and steel remorselessly. Now, some day, whenever the strength for it shall be granted, shore to shore, sea to sea, weapon to weapon opposed. I call down a feud between them and us to the last generation. These things she said, then tried to think of every expedient, seeking the quickest way out of the life she hated. Briefly now she addressed Bassi, the nurse of Sychaeus, her own being dust and ashes, interred in her native land. Dear nurse, please will you get my sister Anna? She must hasten to purify herself with living water, and fetch the cattle, tell her, the atonement offerings as directed. Then let her come. And do you go and put on the holy headband. These rites to Jove of the underworld, duly made ready and started, I mean to go through with now, and put an end to my troubles, committing to the flames the funeral pyre of that Trojan. She spoke. The nurse hurried off with senile officiousness. But Dido, trembling, distraught by the terrible thing she was doing, her bloodshot eyes all restless, with hectic blotches upon her quivering cheeks, yet pale with the shade of advancing death, ran to the innermost court of the palace, climbed the lofty pyre, frantic at heart, and drew Aeneas' sword, her present to him, procured once for a far different purpose. Then, after eyeing the clothes he had left behind, the memoried bed, pausing to weep and brood on him for a little, she lay down on the bed and spoke her very last words. O relics of him!
things dear to me while fate, while heaven allowed, receive this life of mine, release me from my troubles. I have lived, I have run to the finish the course which fortune gave me, and now, a queenly shade, I shall pass to the world below. I built a famous city, saw my own place established, avenged a husband, exacted a price for a brother's enmity. Happy I would have been, ah, beyond words happy, if only the Trojan ships had never come to my shore. These words. Then, burying her face in the bed. Shall I die unavenged? At least let me die. Thus. Thus. I go to the dark, go gladly. May he look long, from out there on the deep, at my flaming pyre, the heartless, and may my death fires signal bad luck for his voyage. She had spoken, and with these words her attendants saw her falling upon the sword. They could see the blood spouting up over the blade, and her hands spattered. Their screams rang to the roofs of the palace. Then rumour ran amok through the shocked city. All was weeping and wailing. The streets were filled with a keening of women. The air resounded with terrible lamentations. It was as if Carthage or ancient Tyre should be falling, with enemy troops breaking into the town, and a conflagration furiously sweeping over the abodes of men and of gods. Anna heard it. Half dead from extreme fear, she ran through the crowd, tearing her cheeks with her nails, beating her breast with her fists, and called aloud by name on the dying woman. "So this was your purpose, Dido? You were making a dupe of me? That pyre, those lighted altars, for me they were leading to this? How shall I chide you for leaving me? Were you too proud to let your sister die with you? You should have called me to share your end. 1 hour, one pang of the sword could have carried us both away. Did I build this pyre with my own hands, invoking our family gods, so that you might lie on it, and I, the cause of your troubles, not be there? You have destroyed more than yourself, me, and the lords and commons and city of Sidon. Quick! Water for her wounds. Let me bathe them, and if any last breath is fluttering from her mouth, catch it in mine." So saying, she had scaled the towering pyre, taken the dying woman into her lap, was caressing her, sobbing, trying to staunch the dark blood with her own dress. Dido made an effort to raise her heavy eyes, then gave it up. The sword blade grated against her breastbone. 3 times she struggled to rise, to lift herself on an elbow, 3 times rolled back on the bed. Her wandering gaze went up to the sky, looking for light. She gave a moan when she saw it. Then did Almighty Juno take pity on her long-drawn-out sufferings and hard going, sent Iris down from Olympus to part the agonized soul from the body that still clung to it. Since she was dying neither a natural death nor from others' violence, but desperate and untimely, driven to it by a crazed impulse, not yet had Proserpine clipped from her head the golden tress, or consigned her soul to the underworld. So now, all dewy, her pinions the colour of yellow crocus, her wake a 1,000 rainbow hues refracting the sunlight, Iris flew down, and over Dido hovering said, "As I was bidden, I take this sacred thing, the death god's due, and you I release from your body." She snipped the tress. Then all warmth went at once. The life was lost in air. Book 5. Meanwhile, Aeneas held his fleet on its course through the deep sea undeviating, and clove the waves that were gloomed by a north wind. He looked back at Carthage's walls. They were lit up now by the death fires of tragic Dido. Why so big a fire should be burning was a mystery. But knowing what a woman is capable of when insane with the grief of having her love cruelly dishonored, started a train of uneasy conjecture in the Trojans' minds. The ships being now well out to sea, no further sight of land in the offing, nothing but sea and sky all round them, an indigo-coloured rain cloud stood overhead, the precursor of gloom and storm, and the sea's face darkened with shuddering cat's paws. Palinurus, the steersman, high on the after-deck, exclaimed, "My God! What does this pack of cloud in the sky portend? Father Neptune, what have you in store for us?" Then he ordered his comrades to make all fast and strain at the stalwart oars, and sailing his ship closer hauled to the wind, he spoke again. "Great-hearted Aeneas, not even if Jupiter guarantees it, have I any hope of making Italy in such weather. The wind has changed and is blowing abeam. The west looks black. A gale is getting up there. Clouds are gathering densely. I am certain we cannot sail in the teeth of that storm, or make enough way against it. Since fortune's too strong for us, we should give in, change course at her direction. The coasts of your brother Eryx are safe, and not far off, I think, and the harbours of Sicily. Let me but remember the stars I steered by last time we sailed there." Aeneas the True replied, "I agree. I have seen for some time that the wind so requires, and you have been making no headway against it. Pay off on this other course, then. What land could be more welcome? Where would I rather get these battered ships to port than the place where my Trojan friend Acestes is still living, and the bones of my father Anchises lie in the lap of earth?" When he had spoken, they turned for port. The sails drew well in the west wind from astern, and the fleet raced over the rough sea, until, elated, they brought up on the sandy beach they knew. Afar, from a high hilltop, Acestes marvelled to see his friends' ships bearing toward his coast. He went to meet them, a rough-looking man with his javelins and the pelt of the Libyan she-bear he wore, Acestes, son of a Trojan dame and the river Crimisus. Thinking now of the Trojan blood in his veins, he congratulates them on their return, genially plies them with rustic plenty, comforts the tired travellers with good cheer. On the morrow, at early dawn, when the bright day had sent the stars packing, Aeneas summoned his men from their bivouacs along the shore to a meeting, stood on a dune, and addressed them. "Proud Dardans, you who trace your lineage from the high gods, 12 months have passed, a year has almost come full circle since we interred the remains, the bones of my own sainted father, and consecrated an altar to him in sorrow. And now, unless I'm mistaken, the day is near which will always be bitter and sacred to me. Such was your will, you gods. Were I spending it as an exile among the Getulian Syrtes, if it came upon me in Mid-Aegean or in Mycenae, I would keep that day with anniversary vows and solemn cortege, loading the altars with the gifts that are proper to them. But now, and I'm quite sure it's with the design and approval of heaven, we're actually close to the spot where my father's ashes and bones are buried. We have been brought to enter this friendly harbour. Come then, let us all with cheerful hearts honour the festival. Pray we for favourable winds. May he grant me, my city founded, yearly to hold these rites at a shrine dedicated to him. Like a good son of Troy, Acestes is contributing 2 head of oxen for every ship. Invite to the feast our own home gods and the one whom our host Acestes worships, What's more, if the ninth dawn from now, with her rays unshrouding the earth below her, should bring a fine day for us to enjoy, I shall hold a Trojan Games. A regatta first for the ships. Then let the champion runners, and those who take the arena confident in their skill at throwing the javelin or archery, those, too, that boldly challenge with the rawhide boxing gloves, let them all come forward, eager to win the palm of the victor. Now silence all for the rites, and garland your heads with greenery. So saying, Aeneas put on a wreath of his mother's myrtle. Helymus did the same, and the ripe-aged Acestes and young Ascanius. The rest of the men there followed suit. Then from the place of meeting, with a great crowd about him, thousands of them, Aeneas moved on to the burial mound. Here, in a ceremonial libation, he poured on the earth two goblets of wine unwatered, two of fresh milk, and two of victims' blood. And scattering bright-colored blossoms, he spoke. I greet you again, my hallowed sire. Greetings, ye ashes, spirit and shade of the father I rescued from Troy in vain. It was not allowed I should have you with me upon my quest for Italy, our destined home, and that mysterious Tiber. So much he had said, when a giant snake came slithering out from under the shrine. It had seven great rolling coils. Inoffensive, it now encircled the barrow, sliding between the altars. Upon its back was a sheen, a dapple of bluish markings and of gold glinting scales, like the shimmer of many colours a rainbow lays on the dark cloud, refractions from the sunlight. Aeneas was awed by the sight. The snake now, dragging its gradual length among the bowls and polished wine cups, tasted the sacramental meats, then harmlessly went back under the burial mound again, leaving the altars he'd fed from. Heartened by this, Aeneas resumed the rites he'd begun in Anchises' honour, not sure if that snake should be deemed his father's familiar or the genius of the place. As the rites require, he sacrificed two sheep, two swine, and two black heifers, poured out wine from the bowls, invoked the spirit of noble Anchises, invoked his phantom, a revenant from death's domain. His comrades too, each man, as his means permitted, with high hearts brought offerings, made sacrifice of bullocks, loaded the altars, while others in turn set up cauldrons and, stretched at their ease, roasted the meat upon spits over the charcoal embers. The day was come they had so looked forward to, the ninth day, dawning fine and calm, brought on by the sun god's horses. Attracted by the name and prestige of famous Acestes, crowds of people were coming in holiday spirits from all round to stare at Aeneas' men, and some to take part in the games. First were the prizes displayed for all to see in the middle of the arena, tripods for sacrifice, green garlands, palm wreaths, the winners' awards, with pieces of armour and clothing purple-dyed and gold and silver weighed out in talents. A fanfare, blown from a mound at the centre, opened the games. The first event was a rowing race, for which four galleys equally matched and chosen from the whole fleet were entered. The speedy whale, with its lively crew, was commanded by Nestius, soon to be Nestius of Italy, and found the Memmian clan. Gaius was skipper of the Chimera, a huge vessel, big as a town, which its Dardan crew propelled with triple-banked oars, three tiers of them, one staggered over another. Sergestus, from whom the Sergian family gets its name, shipped in the great Centaur. Cloanthus had the sea-blue Scylla. From him is descended your family, Roman Cluentius. Well out at sea, right opposite this spindrift-tossing shore, There is a rock, submerged and thumped by a heavy swell at times when the wintry nor'westers blot out the stars from the sky. In a calm, it's a quiet place, lifting above still water a flat top, where the gulls love to perch and bask in the sunshine. Here, Aeneas erected an ilex, leaves and all, as a sea mark for the mariners, to show them where they must turn, and rounding it, row back the length of the course again. Then they drew lots for position. The masters, up on the afterdecks, noticeable from afar in their gold and purple finery, the rest of the crews wearing garlands of poplar leaves, their shoulders bare and shining with the oil they had applied. They get to the rowing thwarts, their arms are braced on the oars. Tensely they wait the starting signal, hearts drained of blood, leaping and pounding with nervousness and the lust for victory. Then a clear